WBAI New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Coming up next is What's Going On, Hour One with Bob Henley. Please stay tuned.
Hey, what's happening?
Brother, what's up?
This is a good recording, man.
Yeah,
I can dig it.
Stop it. Right on.
There's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying.
You know we've got to find a way to bring some love in here today.
Picket lines and picket signs. Punish me,
sister,
with brutality,
sister.
Talk to me,
sister,
so you can see,
sister.
Oh, what's going on?
Good morning, New York and New Jersey, as well as a great world beyond. This is Bob Henley, and this is WBAI's Labor and Social Justice Drive Time News Magazine, What's Going On? It's September 15th, 2025. Michael Lee Haskins is our broadcast engineer. Please be advised that this morning the New York Department of Environmental Conservation is advising that air quality in the five boroughs on Long Island, as well as through the entire Hudson Valley, is moderate, meaning that people with pre-existing coronary and respiratory conditions should consider reducing strenuous exercise outdoors. In Gaza, the Israeli military continues its methodical demolition of one high-rise residential building after another. After issuing an evacuation order for the entire civilian population of Gaza City, the beleaguered territory's biggest population center. Reuters is reporting that the IDF bombed at least 30 residential buildings over the weekend. Israel's ongoing gross violation of international law continues unabated the week after Israel bombed U.S. ally Qatar in a failed attempt to take out Hamas leadership who were in that country to review proposals for a ceasefire. The unilateral expansion of the war by Israel was greeted by global condemnation. Prime Minister Netanyahu is expected to press Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who is in the region, for the annexation of the West Bank as well. The world's leading body of genocide scholars, the International Association of Genocide Scholars, has formally declared Israel's response to the October 7th Hamas terrorist attack that killed 1,200 civilians as genocide. The war in Gaza continues to spark protests inside Israel and around the world, with the civilian death toll now more than 65,000, which includes several hundred from starvation. Later this month here in New York City at the annual UN General Assembly, the United Kingdom, France, and Canada are all expected to call for the recognition of a Palestinian state. The Trump administration's response was to violate the 1947 UN headquarters agreement the U.S. signed by barring Palestinian diplomats from attending the global gathering. Meanwhile, The Guardian is reporting Poland's government is maintaining that a recent Russian incursion with drones into Poland's airspace is an attempt by the Kremlin to test NATO's response. Politico is reporting that President Trump has finally labeled Russia as the aggressor in the war against Ukraine. During the 2024 presidential campaign, President Trump pledged to end both conflicts with lightning speed, but several months into his second term, the United States continues to grow increasingly isolated and alienated from the international community as both shooting wars appear to be expanding. This morning, we will be joined by Yale Global Justice Fellow James Henry and Dr. Joe Wilson, labor historian, union consultant, and biographer of Philip Randolph, the iconic civil rights and union leader. In the B block, we'll check in with Larry Hamm, founder of the People's Organization of Progress, one of New Jersey's leading social justice groups. He'll update us on the growing concerns that a proposed merger between the College of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey, based in Newark, and Robert Wood Johnson Medical School, based in New Brunswick, will lead to the degradation of services offered to Newark residents. We'll also talk about New Jersey's governor's race, which is upon us. In the second hour, we're going to check in with FDNY firefighter Regina Wilson, former president of the Vulcan Society and vice president of the International Association of Black Professional Firefighters. We'll finish up with Monroe County Legislator Rachel Barnard, who represents portions of Rochester, where last week more than 100 local protesters drove out federal ICE agents who were attempting to take into custody workers who were working on replacing a roof in the neighborhood. All that and your calls at 212-209-2877. But first, let's hear from the Public News Service.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Every one of us has to look in the mirror and decide, are we going to try to make it better or are we going to make it worse? I pray that God will help us find him again and find our souls and find each other again.
Utah Republican Governor Spencer Cox went on the major television networks to urge for calm and peace in the wake of the assassination of right-wing organizer Charlie Kirk. Cox says President Trump told him to call for nonviolence, although Trump himself is labeling Democrats and the left as, quote, vicious and horrible. Others on the right are calling for retribution against liberals they call, quote, demonic. Trump is threatening to send the National Guard to Memphis, even as crime there is at a 25-year low. Tennessee's Republican governor says he supports the plan. Pastor Earl Fisher of the Memphis Abyssinian Baptist Church calls it political theater that would do nothing for public safety.
I'm not ruling out that they're not going to try to deploy them to the blackest parts of town, because this is about a show of force. I don't think it's fundamentally about lowering crime, because the facts show that crime is already trending downward.
Fisher questions why troops aren't headed to Utah following the political violence there. Immigration officials have banned non-governmental groups from registering new citizens to vote at their naturalization ceremonies. That's been done for decades, but they say it's too difficult to ensure it's nonpartisan. Celia Canavan with the League of Women Voters of Massachusetts calls the new policy the latest attack on the rights of immigrant communities.
To have that right suppressed from the minute they become a new citizen, it's terrifying. It's a real, real dark day in democracy.
The League registered more than 50,000 new citizens at ceremonies last year. Anti-death penalty advocates are raising concerns about a new Idaho firing squad law. Officials say they plan to build an automated firing squad that doesn't involve humans. Robin Marr with the Death Penalty Information Center says the need to make a machine do the killing shows how immoral it is.
The idea that executions are legal and morally correct really can't be reconciled with efforts to remove responsibility from the people who conduct executions.
U.S. executions have been declining for decades, with Texas, Florida, and South Carolina now performing 6 and 10. Last year, South Carolina carried out two executions by firing squad for the first time since 2010, and in one case, an executioner missed. Four states use firing squads, but Idaho will become the first state where it is the main form of capital punishment. European Union leaders slammed Russia for its second breach of NATO airspace in under a week by drones, this time in Romania. Trump again threatened increased sanctions. Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook is asking a court to reject efforts to fire her, just as newly released mortgage records show she listed a second home as a vacation house, not a primary residence. The central bank is set to vote on interest rates this week. I'm Simone Perez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Thanks. Thanks, Simone. So it's great to welcome back after a little bit of a hiatus, Jim Henry, Yale Global Justice Fellow, lawyer, economist, and investigative journalist. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. How are you, sir?
All right. Considering the status of the world. And Joe Wilson is back, labor historian, union consultant, and biographer of A. Philip Randolph, the iconic civil rights and union leader. Good morning, Dr. Wilson.
Good morning, Bob. Good morning, Jim.
So, Jim, I want to start with, we did have over the weekend talking heads talk about the downward revision of job numbers, that a million fewer jobs were created, troubling numbers about inflation, and then a phrase, stagflation. So you are like the great guy to have in here about this. What is that, and what does the latest data that we're seeing out of the Bureau of Labor Statistics tell us about where we are, you know, several months into Trump 2.0?
Well, it's a great question. I think what we're seeing from the results that are coming in, despite firing the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, Trump's job market is performing miserably. Growth is down. We're having maybe real growth of at most 1% this year, which is about less than half of what it was under Biden last year. And we've also at the same time have escalating inflation. So you get a lousy growth and growing inflation for most Americans. I mean, if you're really rich and you own a lot of stocks, you don't care because AI is powering on. It's coming on like gangbusters, going to unemploy a lot of people. You know, the situation for most Americans is dire. I think they're nervous and worried. It isn't just a question of the current situation that they're in, but it's also what they have to look forward to. Labor market, you know, has underperformed, lost 900,000 jobs, it turns out, in the last since 2025. So on the economic front, I mean, if this was the only issue we would have to worry about, we would have Trump would be on his heels. Let me just say, first of all, that, you know, as someone on the progressive wing of the political spectrum, I do not endorse, nor do I think any leftist has endorsed the murder of Charles Kirk. And the right has polarized this whole situation. I think we have an obligation to speak out against political violence in this country. And it's a complete distortion and myth. The conclusion Trump immediately jumped to, that this was some kind of due to leftist ideology, is just ridiculous. If you want to understand the motivations for that, you have to go dig deep into the background of the young fellow who grew up in a Republican family and turned into a whole Groiper kind of ideology. But I think this whole polarization is affecting not just the political situation, it's also affecting the economy. Firms are not hiring in this situation. They're trying to figure out what's going on, and there's enormous uncertainty and concern on the part of small business and workers in general about all the anxiety that's been created about this political situation. So let me just get that out of the way. I wanted to talk, when we come back to this, just about some of the other factors that are driving this with respect to international influences, specifically the situation we have in Europe right now with Russia moving to escalate. And they sent 19 drones into Poland. Four got shot down. That was not accidental. The leading Republican in the House, McCall, who just decided not to run for re-election, he was deeply involved in the, he was the one fellow who was the strongest supporter of Ukraine, you know, says we are really on the verge of a major confrontation with Russia because of what he's been, because of what Putin has been allowed to get away with. They just sent another drone into Romania last night.
Right.
So what we're missing here is the fact that for all of his rhetoric, Trump has still not really effectively sanctioned Russian oil. Russia depends for about 20% of its GDP and about a third of its government revenues on oil exports. It exports about 7 million barrels per day. The game that it's been playing, let me just take a second to explain this, is that they there's supposedly 50% tariffs on India exports to the U.S., but the Trump tariff regime that he implemented has a 0% tariff on petroleum that's exported from India. India buys about 40% of Russian oil. China buys about 40%. So we have those two big countries which met in Beijing last week really smiling to themselves, because the game is Russia sends about 2 million barrels per day to India. They refine it. They send it back. There is a 0% tax tariff on Russian oil exported by way of India, that's refined in India by the richest fellow in India and sent back to Europe. There's 0% U.S. tariff. There's only a 5% European tariff. So they're basically doing this oil washing on a massive scale. And that is paying for the war. If Trump were really serious, just he told NATO that he would implement sanctions against countries that buy Russian oil. But he said it's only going to be effective if we have all NATO countries agree to stop buying Russian oil. And that's something that's just almost impossible to do. So this is a gigantic charade on the part of Trump. He has not effectively sanctioned Russian oil. Russian oil exports have actually decreased very little since 2022.
So one of the things we have to do is also, I appreciate that we always try to balance the labor with the geopolitical, because what ends up happening, I think, on the conventional corporate news media is that we focus on the macro, and yet our remit, and that's why Dr. Wilson is here. Dr. Wilson, one of the things that we are seeing is that there seems to be a disconnect in the reporting about the economy. So when we hear about this hundreds of thousands of jobs that they're not being created, and this whole softening of the job market, for some reason, I do not hear in the corporate news media any discussion of the acts that they've taken to the federal civil service, which is now, we know that 300,000 fewer African-American women have left the labor force, that this is this direct assault on the American Federation of Government Employees and civil servants that run the United States. And I don't mean bureaucracy. I mean things like the CDC, things like the USDA that Americans rely on. Why is it, I mean, I guess I'm answering my own question, but isn't this really part of this whole right-wing domination, where we see even the discussion in normally like the New York Times, MSNBC, not talking about the role of decimating the public sector in destroying the economy?
No, absolutely. I mean, it's a double-edged sword. You know, obviously, Trump and his policies are destroying hundreds of thousands, indeed, apparently millions of jobs in the energy sector and other sectors. And the tariffs are, you know, causing all kinds of chaos. And as you correctly point out, Black women are at the, you know, suffering from the brunt of this loss of jobs and wages. And of course, you know, civil service has traditionally been, you know, the pathway to the middle class. But more than that, the destruction of the employment opportunities and jobs for Black women is a harbinger for what's going on across the trade union movement. And the trade union leaders, some of them are speaking up, some of them are not, but they're certainly not yet marshaling all of their organizational resources, all of their financial resources to combat, you know, the attacks on civil service and labor. And although, you know, some sectors like white men, their employment has increased by a few hundred thousand. Hispanic women are up by almost a couple hundred thousand. But nevertheless, the economy is in peril. And people just have to check out the coffee prices, the food prices, and check out their electric bills to know that we're heading over the cliff. And it's being guided, again, not only by Trump, but by the corporations who so readily abandoned DEI. They never really believed it in the first place. So we have to be careful to fully lay the blame on Trump, but also fully lay the blame on the corporations, same as in Nazi Germany. Obviously, the Hitler regime was the cutting edge, but all of the German corporations were behind him, and that's what's going on now in the United States.
Well, and Ted, Professor Wilson, staying with you for a second, when we saw that picture of all the tech executives around the president recently, Bill Gates, whatever, it didn't make a difference. And I'm just not wondering, we do know that prior to Ronald Reagan laying off air traffic controllers, some 13,000 air traffic controllers in the early 1980s, density of unions is around 20% of the workforce was in a union. And we know that after that, after he laid off all those air traffic controllers, nothing like near the catastrophic scale of what Trump is doing, we saw a decline right away to like 10%, and private employers walked away. We're now seeing we saw in Utah, the public sector, the state now moving away from collective bargaining. And for some reason, some perhaps maybe skilled building trades, certain law enforcement unions, they think they may rank and file may align with Trump, but they don't understand that this union premium of 15 to 20% additional income that we know union households realize is in peril if they let the entire federal service, federal civil service, be blown up by the junta. And I don't think that they're making that connection yet.
No, you're absolutely right. But I also think that the battle needs to shift focus to the local level. And I think we're seeing some regional and local unions and union confederations stand up and resist and revolt. And even in New York City, while the billionaires, you know, Cuomo has secured their vote, all 123 of them. Nevertheless,
do they have a union, Joe?
The billionaires junta. And but nevertheless, Mamdani is he's rolling with additional endorsements. That belatedly, the governor Hochul has endorsed him. But all of the unions, most of the local unions have. And so I think we need to understand the battle has to also focus on the local civil service and making the connections between federal and local.
Yeah, Jim, I wanted to ask you, because you've been really way ahead of the curve, like Paul Revere on the AI. And if you can talk about the fact that, I mean, we do see it show up in the SAG-AFTRA negotiations. We did a little bit of a story with the News Guild CWA, Asbury Park Press, going up against the behemoth. Gannett got some guarantees. But can you talk about this underlying issue? And we saw all those tech giants around with Trump very recently. What is in store for us? And what do unions and people concerned about working families need to do now?
Well, AI is a cloud on the horizon from one standpoint, which is that, you know, they make money in the industry. They've invested huge amounts in this business, something like $400 billion a year. They have to recover that. They're hoping by selling a lot of displacement. And, you know, it's not just the low end of the skill spectrum. They're talking about lawyers, accountants, there's kind of the whole middle class professionals as well. And many of those folks are not unionized. They've never thought of themselves as having to be, but they'd better get their act together because this is coming. I think that the other impact of AI is going to be on the environment because it consumes a hell of a lot of electric power, and they're reviving the whole nuclear power industry. Governor Hochul, for her endorsement of Mamdani, has basically, talked about reopening Indian Point and putting new reactors within 30 miles of New York City, built by Holtec. This is the company that was going to pollute the Hudson. So this is a shame, and the Democratic Party doesn't really have a position on it. They are, guilty of trying to placate these very wealthy individuals who basically and companies that basically dominate the seven companies that run the AI industry.
Hey, Jim, could you explain? Just triggered something. Can you explain the relationship here in New Jersey? And I think we're seeing real rate shock with electric rates. The relationship, the causality between these energy hogs that are involved with AI and both cryptocurrency?
Well, both cryptocurrency and AI are generating tremendous increased demand for electric power by virtue of the clouds that they require to process the train the models and to run them. Every time you do a search on a ChatGPT, it costs about 20 times more than it does to search on Google in terms of the electricity, electric power. And the grid is just not set up. We don't have a grid that's set up for that. And Trump is canceling wind power and solar across the board. He's turning to fossil fuels and coal. He's trying to revive coal. So this whole AI industry, in addition to its effect on labor market, is creating a power shortage and a booming electrical prices. It's going to take years to adjust the supply of energy, even if we do it with small modular reactors that they're trying to put in. Those are higher cost than the existing nuclear power reactors. We still don't have a solution to the nuclear waste problem. The new reactors produce more waste per wattage hour than the old ones. But I think the other major issue about AI that labor needs to get involved in, they need to be proactive in using this stuff, because it is not going away, and they can use it in a lot of creative ways to increase the productivity and their own productivity and their own role in the labor force. The real question AI poses is, why do we need bosses? And why is it privately owned, by the way? They develop the stuff on the back of the intellectual property of the world, all of the models that were developed in the last decade that have been privately appropriated were based on the commonwealth of human knowledge.
Right,
they basically
right.
ransacked. They paid no copyright royalties to newspapers and to the internet and to those of us who are writers. They just ransacked the whole thing and then developed these models. So it's really like an enclosure.
Great analogy. So, Dr. Wilson, before we go, one of the things we're going to have on is Rachel Barnard, who is a Monroe County legislator up in Rochester. She's also a journalist, and news anchor. There was an extraordinary thing. Talk about convergence of labor and social justice and your subject matter, V. Philip Randolph. We saw happen in Rochester that some individuals were repairing roofs in a community. And the neighborhood, when they saw ICE show up, 100, it's extraordinary video, 100 local residents showed up and drove ICE out of the neighborhood. And I understood they did get one of the roofers, but the tires were slashed on the ICE vehicle, and then they retreated. Can you talk about the significance of this convergence of everyday people, civilians, putting something at risk, maybe even being shot or arrested, to stand up for laborers?
Well, I think that's certainly even in the tradition of the American Revolution, and it's also in the tradition of African-American slave revolts. It's the frontline people who need and who are actually standing up and resisting. And the example that you made has been replicated across the country. It's just that corporate media isn't covering that those kinds of stories. And corporate media isn't really also covering jury nullification, so that the federal government used to be able to so-called indict a ham sandwich. Well, now apparently you can throw a ham sandwich at ICE or at National.
Oh, in D.C. Oh, yeah. That right. Yeah. Tell us more about that.
Well, they, the feds, the Department of Justice, of Injustice, actually, tried to indict a man who threw a sandwich at National Guards, and several jury pools refused to indict. But not only in D.C., but jury pools across the United States who were made up of working people. So working people are resisting, not only protesting ICE, block-to-block battles, house-to-house battles, but also in jury pools and in other ways as well. So that kind of grassroots resistance has to be the go-to and is the go-to because, in my opinion, we're not only in a post-civil rights era, but I think we're in a post-constitutional era, where the separation of powers is gone, the Constitution has been shredded, and it's up to the people to fight for the rights and demand the rights that we've won over a couple hundred years since the American Revolution, and expand them, make them even more just and more fair than as they were set out at the founding.
Yeah, we the people, the ultimate guardrail. In the minute we have left, Jim, what are you looking at ahead this week?
Well, I'm very concerned about the European situation. We have NATO basically being abandoned by Trump, and it's window dressing that he's doing Russia is being very aggressive here, and I expect that theme to continue. That's going to put pressure on the price of oil. That's going to put pressure on the European economy. That's going to put pressure on exports. And I think a lot of the stock market has been riding on, sort of on air. And so I think people are going to finally hot air. The real economy in the United States is in bad shape. People are more concerned about the future, their confidence in the future. Consumer expectations are down sharply. So at some point, I think this has to catch up with the stock market. But so far, it's so dominated by these privatized AI giants that, we have not seen that. So I guess I'm looking forward to, will there be a crack in the bubble as one issue? Maybe not right this week, because they're expecting the Fed to cut interest rates in September, given the lousy performance we've had. So they're all, the market is being propped up by right. that. But we have, a lot of serious concerns about the next year or so of downturn in economic activity.
Well, we'll be here to cover it in detail with keeping an eye on labor and what's happening. Thank you so much. That is Jim Henry, Yale Global Justice Fellow, lawyer, economist, and investigative journalist, and Dr. Joe Wilson, labor historian, union consultant, and biographer of A. Philip Randolph, the iconic civil rights leader and union leader. We'll be back with Larry Hamm in our New Jersey report. Thanks, guys.
See ya.
Take care.
Thanks, Joe.
When I Rise. You tune to WBAI 98.5 FM Labor Radio in New York City and beyond. I'm Bob Henley, and this is What's Going On, the Monday edition. If you find this kind of union, labor-centric public affairs programming works for you, we need you to show your support. We need you to call 1-833-833. That's 1-833-922-4692. That's 1-833-922-4692 or 833-WBAI-NYC. If no one answers because they're busy with other calls, and we sure hope they are, leave a voice message with your name, telephone number, and someone will be sure to get back to you. I guarantee you also a great conversation. You can also send a check or money order. We'd love to get mail at WBAI Pacifica, 388 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn, New York, 11217. That's WBAI Pacifica, 388 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn, New York, 11217. Think about becoming a WBAI buddy, a sustaining member for as little as $10 a month. That's really helpful, and it's going to be essential that we're around 1,300 now. We have 130,000 listeners, so that's 1% doing some heavy lifting. We really need to get like 4% to be self-sustaining. But we could not be on the air right now if not for the sustaining sponsorships from unions representing 3 million households, including the New York City Central Labor Council, AFL-CIO, UAW Local 259, FDNY Vulcan Society, the American Federation of Government Employees, representing 800,000 federal workers in all 50 states, 1199 SEIU, the largest union of healthcare workers in the nation, representing 450,000 members, the United Federation of Teachers, United Auto Workers Region 9A, including New York City, the Hudson Valley, Albany Capital District, as well as Connecticut, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, New Hampshire, Vermont, Maine, and Puerto Rico. 32BJ SEIU, America's largest building service union, representing more than 185,000 workers in 12 states and Washington, D.C. the Uniform Firefighters Association, the Uniform Fire Officers Association, CWA of New Jersey, representing 70,000 public and private sector workers, the Subway Surface Supervisors Association, the Doctors Council SEIU, the New York State Nurses Association, representing over 40,000 frontline nurses, the United Steelworkers Local 4-200, representing nurses at Robert Wood Johnson University Hospital in New Brunswick, New Jersey. They know safer staffing saves lives. That's why they went on strike, to protect it. New Jersey's HPAE, representing 14,000 nurses and allied healthcare professionals. The New York Metro Area Postal Union, APWU, AFL-CIO, Teamsters Local 808, DC 37 Local 983, DC 37 Local 2054, representing workers at CUNY, City University of New York, the Postal Police Officers Association, the United Probation Officers Association, the Environmental Police Benevolent Association, the men and women who protect New York City's vast watershed system. Teamsters Local 210, New York City's second largest Teamster union with a heavy presence in the airline sector across the nation's airports east of the Mississippi. AFSCME's DC 37 Local 3621, FDNY EMS officers. There's still time, Mayor Adams, for pay parity you promised in the last election. And of course, the Transport Workers Union of America.
The rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer, and everyone in between is getting nickel and dimed to death. The only way workers can get a fair shake in this world is by standing together in a union. A union that has the audacity to fight for fair wages, safe working conditions, and quality health care. A union that won't back down. A union that will take on the bosses, the corporate elites, and their lackeys. I'm John Samuelson, International President of the Transport Workers Union. That's what I believe. That's what we believe. Join us. Join the TWU, America's Fight Back Union.
So it's great right now to have the chance to introduce a regular, I guess he's our New Jersey correspondent, or one of them, Larry Hamm, founder of the People's Organization for Progress, one of New Jersey's leading social justice groups that is centered in Essex County and Newark. Good morning, Larry.
Good morning, Bob. How are you?
All right. Well, considering the status of the world, you know, it's mixed. I would like you to update us on this growing concerns at a proposed merger between the College of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey, based in Newark. Of course, there's so much history involved in that. And the Robert Wood Johnson Medical School, based in New Brunswick. And the concern that's being voiced, and there was some good writing on this, from unions and community groups, that this new merger is going to degrade the services that Newark residents have come to rely on. Give us the backstory.
Well, it's a long story, and it certainly, if we had to start in the contemporary era, we would have to go back to 1967, to what's called the Newark Accords, or the Newark Agreement, which was a covenant struck between community leaders and the city of Newark and the hospital administration at that time. It was Newark City Hospital, or also known as Martland at that time, that this only public hospital in the state of New Jersey would serve and provide quality care to the residents of the city of Newark and the state of New Jersey. There was a covenant struck that outlined how this was to take place, to integrate more fully the hospital with the community, to make sure that the hospital had adequate resources, to make sure that there was fair hiring in terms of, at that time, bringing more African-American and Latino staff to the hospital and students to the medical school. So this
just want to also say, I just wanted to say that this was also a consequence of the Newark rebellion, because wasn't the expansion of this facility at one of the driving issues, and it brought to surface the actual corruption of the Adnesio administration, which is something out of a Tony Soprano movie. Eventually, he was convicted. If you could talk about that piece too, because right. this came out of the crucible of that thing that killed dozens of civilians who were shot in circumstances still not properly explained.
Right. And, you know, it was one of the reasons that caused the rebellion, because initially the Adonisio administration, they wanted to wipe out, I think it was, it's some horrendous figure, something like 60 or more acres of the Black community, literally wipe it out in the Central Ward, because the hospital is in the Central Ward of Newark. And so the original idea was to just wipe out that significant portion of the Black community and put this sprawling medical school campus there. And eventually, you know, the Adonisio administration was indicted for corruption. And that same year, well, in 1966, Ken Gibson had run, who was an African-American, had run against Adonisio and lost. But after the rebellion of 1967, he ran again. And while under indictment, the Adonisio administration still fought to a runoff election in May of 1970. But Gibson prevailed and became the first African-American mayor in 1970, first African-American mayor in 350-year history of the city of Newark. But that's just a small part of the story, a big part. There were a number of struggles that led to the rebellion of 1967, not the least of which was the whole issue of police brutality and the beating of a Black cab driver, which actually was the fuse that lit the rebellion in July of 1967. But the medical school story was bound up in that. And that tension between the community and the hospital, the medical school, and all the related agencies has remained until this day, because it's been a constant struggle to make sure that the hospital, because it is a public hospital, so it is dependent upon funding from the state of New Jersey and also federal funding, as well as, you know, funding from the city of Newark. So that struggle is there and continues to go on. And there have been various coalitions over the years that has been navigating this struggle. And the most recent coalition was the one that held the press conference last week that brought us to this story this morning.
Callers, are you from New Jersey? You're a healthcare worker concerned about this? 212-209-2877. We'd love to hear from you. 212-209-2877. So one of the things, Larry, we covered extensively here, the extended strike, and I know that you were People's Organization of Progress was on the picket line, that very long strike with Steelworkers Local 4-200, led by Judy Donnell, the nurses, 1,700 nurses who stood up for safer staffing. They come on every Monday from that August through December. Robert Wood Johnson, of course, Robert Wood Johnson has a research arm that does very important work, and ironically, some of the most important national work about healthcare disparities and the role of racism in poor health outcomes is done by researchers at that foundation. However, the hospital chain itself is very politically connected. We know that they spent close to $200 million to try to break that nurses' strike. We know that in the second year of the pandemic, they paid the CEO $16 million. Is that the concern? Is that this corporate behemoth, I call them Fugazi nonprofits, that bringing that in and having that merge will lead to a diminution of an already, we could say, under-resourced municipal hospital?
That is definitely one of the core concerns. But that is an overlay of a parallel concern that even before the proposed merger, even before this, people were concerned about the disparities in funding, the disparities in pay between the different facilities, and also the quality of care offered at the hospital and the hollowing out that's been going on, because there were services provided by the hospital that were being moved to other hospitals. And this would force residents who lived in Newark to have to travel far and wide to these other hospitals to get service, medical services that previously they could get at the hospital. So all of that is working in tandem, so to speak, to cause this concern that produced the press conference that we had last week, which included speakers from a number of the groups in the hospital coalition. Bishop Jethro James was there from the North Jersey Committee of Black Churchmen, Diomedes Sisoris, representing the union of the professors at the medical school, the president of the NAACP, Deborah Smith Gregory, Ingrid Hill, vice chair of People's Organization for Progress, Deborah Edwards, a former health agency director, Ryan Novosilsky, co-president of HPAE Local 5094, and the other co-president, Benita Herndon, and others, including myself, who all spoke and laid out our concerns. And, you know, my small contribution last week was the fact that I was a patient in the hospital for over a month after having almost been killed in an auto accident. And wow. I felt I received at that time, that was 11 years ago in 2014. You know, I was busted up pretty bad. My rib cage was crushed, 17 broken ribs, broken hand, collapsed lung. I could go on and on and on. And I felt that those people, the staff, both the professional, non-professional staff, the hospital saved my life. And I just wanted to make sure, I want to make sure that everybody is able to continue to get the quality of care that I received 11 years ago.
Right. I have to tell you that I had a, I guess back several years ago, I was working at WBGO covering the election and had an event where I had to go there, a coronary event, and I was very pleased and satisfied with the care received there. I guess it's important now to pivot, because we are in the middle, of course, of a gubernatorial contest. Representative Cheryl is a Democrat's going up against Mr. Cittirelli. We're getting the ads now going wall to wall. And of course, it's important to put the context of this discussion about health disparities and what's happening at the federal level, right? Like, New Jersey is set up because of what Trump is doing with Medicaid to lose 300,000 people, be bounced off healthcare. We know that coming up at the end of the month is a debate about perhaps shutting down the government as Democrats try to blunt some of the most damaging cuts to the Affordable Care Act when they try to unwind the subsidies. What we're hearing so far in the ads here, I think, are doing a disjustice, of course, is that's their job, right, in terms of what we're hearing in the campaign. But one of the things I was surprised to see is that Cittirelli has led off with the tariff on 21 counties. He wants to raise the sales tax on everything to 10%.
I mean, and what is a sales tax? A sales tax is a tax on working and poor people. That's what a sales tax is. And a 10% sales tax. People are already under stress and screaming about the rising cost of everything right now. Imagine a 10% increase in the sales tax on top of that. But there's a deeper story here about the quality of healthcare in our localities, in the state, and in the nation that has to be brought forward again and again and again. And that is our health infrastructure is literally being dismantled before our very eyes under the mission of consolidation. You know, we in the last Bob, in the last 25 to 30 years in New Jersey, we've had over 30 hospital closings. Wow. Now, people didn't talk too much about that until the pandemic in 2020. And at hospitals like University, they had to bring refrigeration units and they had to set up tents outside because the facilities were not adequate to the scale of the suffering caused by the COVID pandemic. And it became quite clear during COVID, and now that COVID is over, you know, it's kind of receding in the background, but the danger is no less present. These Medicaid cuts, nearly, what is it now? Almost $1.8 trillion in Medicaid cuts is going to cause hundreds of thousands of people in New Jersey not to have health care, and it's going to create a major, major crisis. And that's why we had this. That's one of the reasons we had this press conference. And that's one of the reasons that this is going to be an ongoing issue.
Ryan, it's interesting because none of the things I'm seeing, none of the ads are addressing this at all. And it is a catastrophic event that happened with COVID. New Jersey at one point was the deadliest place on earth in terms of the ratio of people dying from the disease. It's important to understand that at the time, Governor Murphy was like, I don't know, he was like the chief undertaker. Every day he'd announce something, someone and give a profile of his favorite sports team. He'd have some endearing detail about them. But meanwhile, New Jersey, its public health safety net failed catastrophically. And it had dire results for the workforce, which is not discussed. I mean, one of the things the society is in denial about is the tremendous impact on healthcare workers and essential workers who died by the tens of thousands. Now, this country, when you die in war, we make sure to put your name on a plaque, back when we still declared wars, and put it in the central square, right? Because the notion is that we owe this to the dead and the living. We want to honor their sacrifice, but try to remind future generations the real cost of war. But in this case, we're in total denial about it. We know, I repeat it over and over again, because we, by the way, COVID is still a thing. It's an occupational hazard, as you know, for healthcare workers.
That's right.
We know that 3,600 nurses and healthcare professionals died in the first wave of COVID for lack of basic equipment like N95 masks and poor staffing. That 500 perished in New York and 300 in New Jersey in the first wave. And yet we had all this discussion about dealing with disparities, and that has totally dropped off the radar. The approach of the Trump administration is to double down on the conditions that led to a mass death event in communities of color. It's that simple. Did I get it wrong?
No, you got it right. And the most amazing part about all of this is that you would think that in the aftermath of such a cataclysmic health crisis that we would have an outcome different from what we have now. And what we have now is a further diminution and dissolution of healthcare infrastructure. You know, it's crazy, you know, and this is why we formed this coalition, you know, around University Hospital. Now, that's just one microcosm of the struggle, because this is really a statewide and a national struggle. I mean, what we really need in the United States, we need a revolution in our entire healthcare system. You know, we have
healthcare is a right, right?
That exactly. Healthcare should be a human right. We should have universal healthcare, Medicaid for all. People shouldn't have to worry about going to a doctor, whether or not they can pay a bill to go to the doctor or go to the dentist. But instead, we have a healthcare system that's based on profit, and in fact, based on really keeping people sick, so that the pharmaceutical companies and other companies can continue to make billion-dollar profits.
And I would say it's scarcity as social control. That's right. What is going on. which you can't do through the Constitution, and what the Supreme Court won't let you do immediately, by destroying the economy. And we're living that. It's unusual to have that as a federal policy, but evidently that's what we're dealing with. Thank you so much, Larry Hamm, People's Organization of Progress.
Thank you, Bob.
Shining a bright spotlight on this potential merger between the College of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey, based in Newark, and the Robert Wood Johnson Medical School, based in New Brunswick. We'll be back on the other side with Regina Wilson, FDNY firefighter and former president of the Vulcan Society and vice president currently of the International Association of Black Firefighters, professional black firefighters.
This is Christian McBride, and you're listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web.
I am going to bring back coal.
Is Law and Disorder.
Hi, I'm Heidi Bogosian.
And I'm Michael Smith. We're here to announce the new time for our program Law and Disorder. It'll now be every Monday at 11 a.m.
Law and Disorder exposes rampant injustices emanating from the U.S. courtrooms, boardrooms, police precincts, and more.
We interview leading experts in the law, as well as authors, activists, and academicians who are working to bring about lasting and positive social change.
We launched the show 18 years ago with the great constitutional human rights litigator Michael Ratner. We've been reinforced by three nationally recognized attorney co-hosts.
Jim Lafferty in Los Angeles, Marjorie Cohn in San Diego, and Julie Hurwitz in Detroit.
Each week, we bring you a one-hour show interviewing legal and political leaders across the country.
Our new time will be Monday morning at 11 a.m. right here on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City.
I'm Rebecca Miles, and I'll be hosting a new show called Frontline Voices, which will air Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays at 12 noon. We'll both feature interviews with prominent journalists, investigative reporters, professors, and activists in our neighborhoods. So join me.
Trauma Code to New York City, Trauma Code to WBAI. I am Dr. Simon Fitzgerald, a Brooklyn trauma surgeon and surgical intensivist.
And I am Dr. Cassandra Raphael, an adult and child psychiatrist.
And welcome to Trauma Code. Together, we will focus on healing of mind, body, and community from trauma.
We'll discuss how wellness fits into the culture at large. Join us on Monday at 2 p.m. on WBAI.
For
For the better part of a century, Hour of the Wolf has given WBAI listeners the opportunity to listen to many of the great classic voices of science fiction and fantasy literary luminaries, ranging from Octavia Butler.
I had God charge Martha with creating a better human species.
To Frank Herbert.
Kabbalah is a person who can be many places at once.
From Ken Liu. To Ursula K. Le Guin.
Physiologically, for 25, 26 days a month, they are no gender. They are ungendered beings. And then they go into heat.
We also bring you many of the up-and-coming creators in the field, as well as genre movie reviews. In the past, you had to visit Morning Twilight or Witching Hours to hear the show, but now you can find host Jim Freund with new guests and classic recordings as part of WBAI's Art Strip, Monday nights at 9 p.m. Join us.
WBAI New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. It's 7 a.m. here in New York.